Next case will be 081071, Hartford Fire Insurance Company v. United States. Mr. Van Arnum.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Frederick Van Arnum. I represent the appellant, Hartford Fire Insurance. Now, the single issue before the court today is whether Hartford's complaint challenges the decision of the Customs Service or sets out a challenge to the underlying bonded issue here.
But you filed this suit because you don't believe that you should have to pay customs pursuant to the bond, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
How is that not a dispute that's within the charge language of subsection A?
Well, first, I don't think it's a dispute because Customs hasn't made a decision here. I don't think Customs is empowered to make a decision on a contract action. And let me explain. When you look at our case, our claims seek rescission of the bond and discharge of the surety. Now, those claims accrue independent of any Customs decision or Customs action. The contract is entered into, and at any time thereafter, in theory, we would have a right to rescind that contract and seek discharge. And let's look at this in the context of the surety world and customs bonds. An importer comes to a surety and says, I need a continuous bond to cover all my customs entries for the next year. And we enter into that agreement on day one. And sometime thereafter, the importer decides it's going to start making customs entries. And for purposes of my hypothetical, let's just say it's 60 days later. Now let's say then on, say, day three or four, the surety learns of situation facts that give it cause to believe that its risk has been increased. And it wants to have a way to go and get out from its obligations under the bond. It would have the right at that time to seek rescission and have the right to seek discharge from its obligations under the bond. Now, at this point in time, there's been no customs decision. Frankly, there's been no customs activity or no customs action at all to challenge. But we still have an accrued cause of action, and we still need an avenue to court so that we can go to get relieved of that obligation. And that clearly lies in 1581I. Now, the lower court said no. They looked at the remedy that we were requesting and said, all you're really trying to do is get out from underneath paying this obligation. And it basically said you need to file a protest.
Which is right, correct?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. That the result of, if this case gets put back on the calendar and we're successful in rescinding the bond, our obligation to perform thereunder will be discharged as to this claim and any other claim that could arise under the continuous bond. But if we are forced to file a protest first, situations could arise where my client could lose a claim, could have a cause of action in effect taken away from it. And let me give an example. Using my hypothetical of the bond being entered on day one, and on day five, we discover that, in fact, the principal obligor, the importer, through material misrepresentation, had induced us to enter into the surety agreement. Now, at that point in time, that bond is voidable at the election of the surety unless the obligee, in this case the government, has in effect provided a benefit or relied to its detriment on that bond. Now, if there's been no customs activity, if there's been no entry, if there's been no liquidation, if there's been no demand, I would respectfully argue that customs has not relied on that bond and we would have a right to come to court and seek.
Hasn't there been a demand here?
In my hypothetical, there hasn't been. In this case, there has. But my point I want to try to show here is that if we are forced to wait until there's a customs action, at that point in time, customs will have relied on the secondary obligation.
Well, you didn't pay, did you?
We haven't paid it, no. But we're in court
trying. Not so terrible. If you had to wait for customs to take action,
I'll address that a little later this morning because I think there's a very important thing we have to understand.
A little later this morning, we won't be here.
Well, anyway, I was just hoping I'd just finish my hypothetical here because I think it answers Judge Prost's question in that if we have to file a protest, that means we would have to wait until customs took an action. And once customs takes an action, we lose the right to come in and have that surety bond voided based on the fact that there was material misrepresentation. So that's a clear ramification of having to file a protest on one of these charges. Now, Judge Lurie, to address your question, this court has been clear in both the UTEX case and in the St. Paul case that a surety's rights to defend in a 1582 action, defend on contract claims, survives liquidation. Now, the end result of the lower court's case in the lower court's decision in the Hartford case will lead to a totally different result if this case is affirmed. Now, let me explain. What the lower court has done is it has taken our contract claims and said, you need to file a protest on the demand. We're going to take your contract-based claims and we're going to basically make you raise them at the agency level first. In Cherry Hill, the Federal Circuit said that a defendant in a 1582 collection action brought by the government against a surety to pay on a bond cannot, in fact, sit back and raise as an affirmative defense a claim that could have been protested and brought to court under A jurisdiction. So what the lower court's decision has done is taken those contract claims and converted them into an A action, which now under Cherry Hill, we would no longer be able to sit back and exercise our rights to be a defendant and to challenge the existence of the contract.
Mr.
We would
Mr. Bonham, you argue that you needn't have proceeded under 1581A.
That's correct.
But and you want to proceed under I.
Yes.
But I refers back to A, civil action commenced that arises out of any law providing for, presumably for, administrative enforcement with respect to matters referred to in subsections A to H.
Through H, yes.
So you're saying A doesn't apply, but I does, even though it goes back to A.
Well, it doesn't go back, it goes back to, as I read I, it creates a right of action of a private party to sue the government based on the administration and execution of the customs laws as they're enumerated in A through H as well as in 1581I, Roman numeral 1 through Roman numeral 3. So it's not just simply that there's A jurisdiction. It's that basically there has to be a decision that was within the jurisdiction of the Court of International Trade.
So, but it's only when it needs to have been manifestly inadequate to go under A, right? In order to
go under I? No, you can have claims that are not manifestly inadequate, but they clearly fit within I. Again, I think this is...
But if a claim fits within A and I, you go with I. A will go with A, right?
If a claim is clearly within the scope of A, the way the courts have interpreted the statute, starting from the Miller case forward, is that A would control. But in our situation, there is no A jurisdiction. This is our claim. And we don't believe Congress intended there to be A jurisdiction over contract claims, especially ones where we're asking for equitable relief. Now, I need to point out that the surety relationship...
Well, what relief are you asking for that you wouldn't get under A? Wait, what is the relief you're seeking?
We're seeking to have the bond rescinded and to have our surety's obligations that arise under the bond discharged.
Okay, which means you wouldn't be accountable for the payment.
We won't be accountable for this payment or any other payment that might arise under this bond. So we're seeking relief from the contract. We're not challenging Customs' statement that we owe this money. And it's really questionable whether or not Customs has actually made a decision here, because the underlying claim here is that the Department of Commerce has said that there are additional anti-dumping duties owed on this particular transaction. And Customs has simply said to the importer and now to the surety that you need to pay these dumping duties. In the Mitsubishi Electric case, the Federal Circuit held that A jurisdiction wasn't a proper avenue for the importer to challenge any dumping duties because Customs in that situation was simply acting in an administrative manner. It wasn't making any decision. So if the importer can't challenge under A this type of claim, why is it that the surety should be able to challenge it under A? But I think one really important point I want to make also before I go here is that Congress did not clearly grant to Customs the authority to adjudicate contract actions where private rights are involved. Now remember, it's not just the surety and the government here, you have the importer as well. And rights and liabilities flow back and forth between the importer and the surety. And in my example with the material misrepresentation, the actions of the principal obligor would lead to discharge of the surety. So if we had to go to Customs would be put in the role of having to adjudicate whether or not there is in fact a material misrepresentation.
And but you didn't bring the other party in your ICE, right?
We haven't yet, no, but we've been thrown out of court. But that's certainly a possibility because 28 U.S.C. 1583 allows for third-party practice. So once we have that, we can bring in the third party. At the agency level, we don't have that. And if you look at what Congress did in the Customs Court Act of 1980, one thing they did was they went to the jurisdictional section that controlled the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims. And as you know, the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction over express and implied contracts involving the United States. In the Customs Court Act of 1980, Congress carved out an exception and said anything that's within any contract dispute within the jurisdiction of the Court of International Trade is out of the jurisdiction of the Court of the Court of Claims and into the Court of International Trade. Then Congress created 1582, which allowed the government to bring a collection action against a surety. It passed 1583, which allowed third-party practice and counterclaims and cross-claims. So now the surety can, in fact, bring in the private party so that the court can adjudicate all these various rights, which will have an impact on my claim. At that same time, the Customs Court Act of 1980 implemented I-jurisdiction, allowing this broad residual jurisdiction so that a private party could sue the government over the government's actions if they related to the execution and enforcement and administration of the customs law. What Congress didn't do in the Customs Court Act of 1980 was go into 19 U.S.C. 1514A and add a new enumerated section saying that the Customs Service decision as to the enforceability of an implied or express contract is final as a matter of law.
The Byrd Amendment has been repealed, right?
It has been, yes. So, I'm into my rebuttal time here, so unless there's questions, I can reserve it till later.
Let's hear from the other side
now.
Mr. Is it Dierberg or Dierberg?
Dierberg,
yeah.
May it please the court, the trial court correctly dismissed this case for lack of jurisdiction. Hartford does not dispute that a demand against the surety is normally a protestable matter, and that a demand against the surety is a charge which may be protested. But what they state is that this is not the type of claim, that their particular claims are not the type of claims that could have been protested.
But it's also, they argue, that they couldn't get the relief that they really seek by going through A.
That's absolutely wrong, Your Honor. Customs has broad authority over customs bonds. They're the one who issue the form that governs the bond. They by statute, have authority over the interpretation of the bond, the enforcement of the bond, broad authority, and they've exercised that authority through regulation and through protest. And in fact, as we demonstrated in our brief, they have actually, Hartford has in the past protested, in that case, a slightly different matter about the form of the bond, but Customs granted the relief they requested in that protest and canceled the charge against the bond. So, and Customs, that's entirely within Customs' authority to cancel the demand. Customs issued the demand against the surety. That was a protestable charge, and Hartford's failure to protest that means that that charge is final and conclusive. Because Hartford did not protest that within the time period required.
What about if I've got a claim about the Byrd Amendment, that it's either unconstitutional or that it's, you know, challenging the Byrd Amendment? Would I have to bring that under A?
Your Honor, well, actually there is a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality that has been brought under A that will be heard next month. That will be entertained under I. It was decided under I by the trial court.
So in that case, when you're challenging the Byrd Amendment, they conceded that the jurisdiction was not to be found under A, but rather under I.
Yes, right? I would say that's a really different context, too, because that was brought by basically domestic parties challenging their lack of receipt. They did not receive Byrd money or CDSOA money, and they were challenging their non-receipt of that money.
And so why is that under I? I mean, how come in this case you say Customs has the authority to get into the bond, to abrogate the bond, but it doesn't have the authority to declare a statute unconstitutional? I mean, is that the difference between this and the other case?
No, Your Honor. In that case, it's not an issue of a charge, you know, whether or not the charge was valid or
what
the contest
okay,
of the charge.
So forget the other case. Hypothetically, if you want to challenge the charge by saying that no, I'm not paying the charge because the Byrd Amendment is unconstitutional, and you shouldn't be given this money that I pay to domestic industry. Would that go under A or I? Could you bring that under I?
Your Honor, I think you have a lot stronger argument that it would go under I. This Court has in the past decided cases where it's held that that it's proper to proceed under I, where it's a challenge to the constitutionality of a statute.
And why is that? Is that because it's clear that Customs does not have the authority under A to abrogate a statute? Is that the basis for it?
I think that's essentially the basis, that Customs has no authority to decide the constitutionality of a statute, which is supposed to enforce. And that was, I think, the basis for that decision. Although there are instances in which statutes have been held to require exhaustion of remedies where there is even a challenge to the constitutionality of statute, and recently this year the Supreme Court decided a case where it held that even the constitutionality of the statute the party needed to exhaust its remedies. But I also want to add
that was
United States versus Clintwood, and it was, I think, in spring. So I think it would be a question for the Court whether or not a challenge to the constitutionality of the statute could be raised, but this Court has in the past found that that is an issue that was without, Customs was without authority to decide and decide along those lines. But that's nothing like the case here. I think it's important to really examine the nature of these claims here to see what is it that they're asserting. What they're asserting is, and what they're seeking is, a cancellation of the demand that Customs issued. This case is all about money. Customs issued demand.
Well, except they say there it's also about the bond, and that would apply in other cases and not just in this case.
Well, Your Honor, that's not correct, because what they're seeking in this complaint, and all they really can seek, is that you have a couple single-entry bonds. As the name implies, a single-entry bond only applies to single entries. That is, the entries in this case. You also have a continuous entry bond, and that bond only applies for a certain period of time, and essentially the demand here used up that entire period. Now, it is possible to have a bond roll over and roll over, but I think it's important to note that the CDSOA was passed in the year 2000. These bonds were executed between 2002 and 2004. So if Hartford continued to roll this bond over year after year and has continued to roll this over even while engaging in litigation regarding the validity of the bond, then it would raise serious questions. And it's not an issue in this case because they're challenging just their obligation to pay under the bond.
What is this case about, basically, a failure to exhaust administrative remedies?
It's partially that, Your Honor, that the statute requires 1581A and the whole scheme of 1581, and also 1514 requires first a protest with Customs. So it's partially about exhaustion of remedies, but it's also partially about a statute of limitations and a limitations period, because Congress required a specific procedure to be followed. And that procedure is to file the protest when there's a charge or when there's a protestable matter. You file a protest within a certain period of time. Hartford did not do that. And so it's about both. It's about the limitations period and the exhaustion of remedies.
Is there a longer, it's 180 days for A, right?
Yes.
And what is it for
I? 2 years from the accrual of the cause of action for I.
What about the Cherry Hill case that the other side cited, which I didn't recall necessarily from the briefs?
Well, Your Honor, the Cherry Hill case is not as they suggest. The Cherry Hill case said that if it is protestable, you cannot use that protestable matter as a defense in your, if the government brings suit against you, you cannot use that as a defense. And they said that essentially if they were to hold otherwise, that would open a gaping hole in the administrative scheme, which you can understand. If you could just sit back, wait around, and hope not that the government sues you, and if they do, just use whatever issue you should have raised, then the whole process would be undone by allowing you to proceed in that matter. The issues here and the relief that they seek are fully within Customs authority. What they're claiming is that the CDSOA effectively changed or affects the language of the bond such that they're not obligated under the bond, that they agreed to pay the United States, but they didn't agree to pay the United States and have the United States then use some of that money to provide to the domestic parties. This is essentially an issue of interpretation of the bond. In order to decide this, you looked at the bond and you see, what does it say? It says you pay the United States. And they presumably will say that, no, it should have said we'll pay, you know, we agree to pay the United States for these limited purposes, or try and narrow the context in which you can pay, you know, you're obligated to pay the United States. That's just an interpretation of bond issue fully within customs authority.
They also say that type of case that would be appropriate, however, to bring in the other party.
They haven't sought to bring in the other party.
But let's assume they had.
Yes.
Isn't the other party kind of necessary to resolve this dispute, and wouldn't they be precluded from bringing in that other party under A rather than under I?
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's any difference whether it's A or I in terms of if they could. I'm not sure that they actually could bring in another party, but even assuming they could, I'm not sure it matters for purposes of whether they could bring them in, whether it's A or I. But I think it's important to note that they haven't really, I mean, this is really the first I've heard that they have any thought of actually bringing in another party. The claim here, it's not a private party, not a private dispute. This is a dispute, I represent the government. The government asserted a claim against Hartford. Hartford is now challenging that demand and saying, well, we don't want to pay. That's a claim against the government, and I represent the government.
Except they didn't protest.
Exactly, Your Honor, they didn't protest. And our point is that they should have protested and followed the procedure that Congress required. And speaking of what Congress requires, I think they pay lip service in their brief to the rule that's well-established and settled law that jurisdiction under 1581I is not available unless another subsection, jurisdiction another subsection is available or could have been available unless manifestly inadequate. That law has been in existence since 1983 and has been reaffirmed through at least 20 decisions of this court. It's settled law. What they do in their brief is then try to cite to Supreme Court cases that address other statutory provisions and suggest that these cases suggest perhaps a balancing of interests. And those cases are not applicable to this statute, and their effort to challenge what is settled law in this case should be rejected. They also raise the issue, at least in their brief, they raise this issue of manifestly inadequate. That is not an issue that they raised below to the trial court. That's an issue that they should have raised. It was their burden to demonstrate whether or not the remedy was manifestly inadequate. They did not contend it was manifestly inadequate. That's essentially an alternative argument. And to the extent that they claim that their remedy was manifestly inadequate, I think it's important to note that they provide this hypothetical of what would have happened had they challenged this before the demand. Well, they didn't. But the remedy that they don't mention is that they didn't have to enter into these bonds. No one required them to enter into these bonds. The CDSOA was passed in the year 2000. These bonds were entered into between 2002 and 2004. So the remedy that they ignore is just not entering into those bonds. But as soon as and when Customs issued that demand, then the statutory provisions triggered that within a certain period of time, they had to protest. Otherwise, it became final and conclusive. The demand against Hartford was final and conclusive because they didn't protest. They didn't follow the statutory procedure. And therefore, they cannot use 1581I to pursue their claims. They also today compare this case to Mitsubishi, a case in which the issue is really about a commerce decision. And then Hartford suggests today that perhaps this somehow related to a commerce decision. This case has nothing to do with a commerce decision. They don't dispute and don't dispute in the complaint that there are anti-dumping duties, and they don't dispute anything about what commerce did. What they dispute is their obligation under the bond, and that bond is a matter wholly within customs authority. It's in customs authority to interpret, and it's in customs authority to enforce, as it did here, by issuing a demand against Hartford. Unless there are any further questions, we respectfully request that the court affirm the decision dismissing for lack of jurisdiction.
All right, thank you. Mr. Granato. I was curious why you brought up the Cherry Hill case and your support when it seems to cut against you.
It does. What I'm trying to use Cherry Hill to point out is that if this court affirms the Hartford lower court decision, what in effect you will be doing is telling the suretyship world, that if you have a claim that goes to the nature of the contract, the enforceability of the surety bond, you need to file a protest. Because if you don't file a protest, Cherry Hill says you cannot raise that as an affirmative defense if the surety elects to sit back and be sued under 28 U.S.C. 1582. And 28 U.S.C. 1583 gives both parties the right to third-party practice. So for Mr. Dierberg to say that doesn't exist, that's just not the case. If we have to go into court under A jurisdiction, we will lose the right to bring in the private party. A surety has an equitable right to...
Well, he said you didn't think it mattered whether it was... Probably didn't matter whether it was I or A. In any event, you didn't ask for it. So it isn't here.
If we are on I jurisdiction, we have clearly can bring the party in through 1583. If we're in A jurisdiction, we don't have the authority to do that. If we are getting to, if we get directly into court through I jurisdiction, then clearly 28 U.S.C. 1583 is applicable. And as a surety, we have a right to exoneration against the principal obligor. We can bring them into court and say, you need to pay your debt. This is an equitable principle.
So your rule would be any time that a party hasn't but might want to bring in a third party, private party, then the case should be adjudicated under I.
Well, I think in that case, because what you have to do is you have
to look at
you need to look at the core of the complaint, and if it goes to the contract, the enforceability of the contract, I don't see an enumeration under 1514A saying that Customs has the right to review the express and implied contracts with the government. I think these are cases that clearly I jurisdiction are intended to handle. It allows the private party the option. You can either sit back and be sued under 1582, and in UTEC says if that's the case, then you can raise these defenses. Or you can go into court under 28 U.S.C. 1581I as a plaintiff against the government to seek relief as a plaintiff. And in that case, then you could certainly bring in the third party, and you could have a court adjudicate all the equitable rights that are flowing between the three parties. Now, as for the issue about manifestly inadequate, the lower court made a finding that that in its decision, in its opinion, the remedy was adequate. So clearly, this court can address that on appeal. And I would just put to the court, how is it that we can have an adequate remedy if we're forced to file a protest with the Customs Service, who is a party to the action, asking them to rescind the contract, where we're saying to them that you have complied with the Byrd Amendment, and in doing so, you've put yourself in breach. It would be a predetermined outcome if we asked them to do that. They're not going to say, you're right, we can't follow the law of Congress. As you pointed out, Judge, that clearly Customs can't abrogate a statute. They can't simply disregard the Byrd Amendment to keep them from being in breach of our contract. So to go and ask them at the agency level would be a futile effort. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor, and I would ask that the lower court's decision be reversed.
All right. Thank you. Case is submitted.